This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Have fun growing your own tomatoes. Have fun milking your own cows. Like, that's not going to happen. A lot of people feel like they feel very disconnected from where their food comes from. Unless you go to a farmer's market. Where does this come from at the grocery store? I don't know. And I can understand why a farmer in today's society would feel that way. Nobody ever says, like, hey, good job.
Today is a different kind of Talk Farm to Me episode. No farmers are here today, but don't be sad. I think you're going to like this conversation. Our guest today is going to serve as our connector, our interpreter, and arbiter of the nexus between farmers and the government. She is America's government teacher and a major influencer, if there ever was one, in the history of nerdy government, politics, and U.S. history. For starters, she has over 1 million devoted followers on her Instagram account, Sharon Says So. As a community, her followers are governerds, where it's super cool to be a nerd. I am one of them. What's more is that hundreds and hundreds of her followers participate in her book club, which features lively but respectful discussions among readers, and then the authors themselves to answer questions and to hear about reader reactions. Speaking of books, today's guest just announced the title and cover art for her first book that is due out in September of 2024. And in less than 24 hours, it became a bestseller in all of the categories: history, civics, political science, and it topped the Amazon book list of 33 million titles, number one from pre-sales before it's even released or finished. When she books live speaking gigs, they're sold out. When she talks about political events, she applies history and the rule of law. She was a history teacher, and she still bangs the drum for teachers across the country, raising millions in minutes to support them and their classrooms. She recently interviewed Vice President Kamala Harris for her award-winning podcast, Here's Where It Gets Interesting. Today, Sharon McMahon is here on Talk Farm to Me, trying to help us make sense of the intersection of farmers and government, and particularly politics. If anyone can do it, it's Sharon. Today, we spend the next 40 minutes with her. Let's just set the table. We could talk about anything here. Farmers are quite literally at the nexus of everything, whether you see them there or not. So when we talk democracy, politics, government, there they are. Like you and me, Sharon has farmers in her family history. We all do somewhere. But even more common among us is our lost connection to the farm and the farmer who works it in service to us all. We need farmers in every community. They do the work we no longer do for ourselves.
Let's talk about the Venn diagram of farmers and our government. And I thought it would be really interesting to start with something that I saw that you shared on your stories of a Republican farmer speaking out very loudly about Jim Jordan becoming our speaker, which obviously he did not, but that you were really, I think, intrigued and surprised about Republican farmers taking on a different role politically. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Before Sharon answers, I'll just remind you that in 2023, there was some buzz around Jim Jordan becoming the speaker, because in his 15 years As a representative in a largely rural district in central Ohio, he had not once voted for a farm bill. This was obviously a problem for farmers, which caused them to speak out, since farm bills contain key funding for federal food assistance programs that farmers rely on, and much more that affect farmers in a big way.
I just thought it was interesting to see people who, as you've mentioned, are often invisible, but yet are actually the bulk of the basis of the tapestry of America, right? Like, who would we be without farmers? Yet, so often they are so hard at work at what they're doing that they don't step out from behind taking care of the animals, or they don't step out from behind the food that they're growing to talk to normal people, right? They're busy. So I just thought it was an interesting perspective that he shared. This particular farmer has been very involved in Ohio Republican politics for a long time. Like, he had been a committee chair in his community and was not just like a disinterested observer. He was very involved in the Republican Party. And he made this video where he talked about, here's my farm. Here's how I've been involved in Republican politics for a long time. Here's what I do. And here's why I think choosing Jim Jordan as speaker would be dangerous for farmers. And it has a lot to do with farm bills. Almost all farmers in the United States are very familiar with the ag bills that are in front of Congress and how important they are and how integral those agricultural bills are to making sure that Americans can eat. And making sure that our cash crops continue to get planted, grow, feed animals, like, I mean, all the things. Those ag bills shouldn't be messed with, right? We should not be like using them as a wedge issue. Farmers should not be part of the culture war. What they do is too important for us to spend time arguing about them. So in the same way that we can think of other topics that are just so important to Americans, things like Social Security, taking care of senior citizens who have been promised something, who worked their whole lives, relied on it, we can understand how important that is to society to continue to honor those commitments. And we can't just get new farms. Okay, yes, somebody can open a small-time operation, but to grow food at the magnitude that we need to grow it, to be able to ranch at the magnitude that it needs to happen, where would that new land be coming from, right? We need to protect the farms that we already have, and we need to protect the farmers that we already have, and it's not something to be trifled with, and it's not a wedge issue, and we should not be using it for political clout, and we should not be acting as though farmers are expendable when they're absolutely not.
When you say that farmers are caught in this culture war, what do you mean?
What I'm talking about is the culture war arguing that happens in Congress that is not productive, that is not working on behalf of Americans. And we can all think of a variety of culture war issues that are very prevalent in the United States right now, whether that is related to public schools or related to bathrooms or LGBTQ issues, or there's a variety of very hot button culture war issues that people have differing viewpoints, sometimes based on their religious viewpoint. But farmers should not be part of that equation. You go ahead and argue about who should be on the school board and, you know, feel free to have those arguments and discussions. That's great. But farmers are the backbone of society. They should not be caught in the crosshairs of a culture war.
I guess that leads me to, here we are, right, in the middle of politics and in a year where a farm bill is supposed to be passed to support our farmers, which includes a lot of other things besides just thinking about farmers, but in terms of helping to feed people who need assistance, the SNAP is a huge part of the farm bill. So it really extends across society. And yet we are arguing about these other more less central to the operation of our society. We're not allowing this to go through. So I feel like in some ways, farmers are a pawn in all of this. And I don't understand why, when farmers have been since our founding, the backbone of our society, that now they are, like I was saying before, like invisible and pushed to the side a little bit, like, well, we're not going to pass the farm bill now. What's going on with that?
The reason that this is happening has nothing to do with the quality of the work that farmers are doing or the importance of the work that they're doing. It is to make a political point. It is because it is more politically expedient for some members of Congress to engage in partisan bickering than it is for them to actually move the needle on passing legislation that impacts millions of Americans. Often in these omnibus bills that are made up of a variety of different types of topics are things like SNAP benefits for children.
An omnibus bill is a comprehensive legislative proposal that addresses diverse and unrelated issues within a single piece of legislation. It aims to streamline the legislative process by consolidating various measures into one bill, facilitating efficiency. Critics argue that this approach can hinder thorough examination and debate of each component, while proponents emphasize its ability to address multiple policy areas simultaneously. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is a federal assistance initiative in the United States designed to offer nutritional benefits to qualifying low-income individuals and families. It used to be called the food stamp program, and it plays a crucial role in farm bills, which frequently encompass provisions concerning agricultural and food policies.
So that families can get what is commonly referred to as food stamps to be able to make sure that their kids can eat. These are literal fundamental issues of society. And one of the big challenges here is thinking about why the incentive structure in Congress has become so distorted. It used to be, and I'm not one that just romanticizes the past and like, oh, it used to be so wonderful back in the 1920s, and now it's not. There are certainly wonderful things about the past, but also we've made excellent progress in other areas. But it used to be that somebody would get elected to Congress based on what they had accomplished for their district or their state, right? Like I helped make sure that the farmers of Missouri or the farmers of Indiana, whatever state somebody is listening from, I helped make sure that they had what they needed. And that was how somebody could continue to get reelected. They maintained their own power based on the results that they were delivering for their constituents. And now the incentive structure has changed. The incentive structure has changed so that it is no longer based on results that a member of Congress has achieved for their district or their state, and instead is based on how much that representative or senator has stuck it to the other side. How bad have I made the other side look? How much do you hate that other guy running? Good, then vote for me instead. So they spend all of their time engaged in culture war issues for TV cameras, because those are the viral moments that get replayed on the news, that make the rounds on social media. Those viral moments then fill their coffers with money to then continue to consolidate and maintain their power. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the primary reasons that people who are engaged in this type of behavior, and that's not to say every single member of Congress, there are some good ones, but we can all probably think in our minds about somebody in Congress where we're like, oh no, not them. You know what I mean? Like we can probably all picture somebody. The reason they do it is because they are incentivized to do it because they get money when they do it. When those moments go viral, when you see the person sitting in a committee lambasting a person who is there to testify, they literally hear ka-ching. They literally see the dollar signs whirring. They can raise millions of dollars from one viral moment. And that is how they consolidate and maintain power, where it used to be based on what kind of results are you getting for my district? Mm-hmm. Most districts do not think that they are benefiting. Most Americans, Congress has a terrible approval rating right now. It's one of the worst approval ratings that has ever existed. This is one of the least productive Congresses that has ever existed. That used to not be the case. If you didn't bring home the proverbial bacon for your district or state, then you just weren't going to stay in power.
I think it's interesting the evolution of politics with farmers now, as opposed to before. Now we have less than 2% of our population are farmers. So they're less of a voting bloc. Although I thought, even going back to that video, we typically had farmers fitting into maybe a more Republican political space. I'm wondering just if you understand the history of all of that and how they got there. I'd love to talk about where they've come. And I think it goes back to power a little bit. Obviously, the power dynamic has shifted to face those viral moments. But those viral moments used to be more centered around what a farmer had to say.
I think it's very multifaceted, but I can point to a few things. One is, as society has developed, and we have seen this rapid period of growth post-World War II and during America's Great Migration, where millions of African Americans from the South, many of whom were agricultural workers, left the South, millions, tens of millions, left the South and moved to northern urban areas. We began to see the demographics of farming change. But additionally, it used to be that people in Congress, even the presidents, either came from a farming background or they had relatives that were farmers. You know, you think about like Dwight Eisenhower, Harry Truman, we can think of a ton before them. But as late as the mid-20th century, these were men who came from family farms or their families were farmers. And so they had a very intimate knowledge of what it took to be a farmer, why being a farmer was important. And as we've developed technology that has made farming more efficient, as large corporations have purchased a lot of farmland and created these giant agricultural conglomerates, and we moved away, shifted away from the same number of family farms and into more corporate farming. Farming as an industry, farming as a profession, I think all of those things have contributed to this sort of erasure of farmers in government, this erasure of farmers who then go on to achieve some kind of political power. I mean, one of FDR's vice presidents started a seed company. FDR had multiple vice presidents. At one of them started a seed company. He worked in agriculture before he became a vice president. Very, very well known in the agricultural industry. So it used to be that farmers could and would achieve the highest levels of governmental power.
The vice president who started a seed company was Henry A. Wallace. Wallace served as vice president from 1941 to 1945. After leaving the vice presidency, he became a prominent agricultural scientist and entrepreneur. Wallace played a significant role in the field of agriculture and made contributions to the development of hybrid crops.
You know, John Adams had his little farm in Braintree, Massachusetts. And of course, we all know that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, et cetera, used enslaved laborers on their very large plantations and farms. So this idea that farmers were in charge is fundamental to the American experiment. And that has, since the mid-20th century, that has no longer been the case. Now, LBJ had a ranch, but he was in politics for most of his adult life. His was like a hobby ranch, maybe. His initials were LBJ and his wife's initials were LBJ. And so consequently, they named all of their children with the LBJ initials and they named their dogs with the LBJ initials. I think it was more like, we got some horses. You know, that was a little bit more of like, we got some land and we got some horses and sometimes we ride them. I can think of one other farmer president, which is Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer, and he actually legitimately was a peanut farmer, like legitimately worked his family's farm. But since then, since the 1980s moving forward, the last 40 years, people might have had some land in Texas and some horses, like the Bushes, but they were not out there for money. And I'm not saying that none of these presidents care about farmers or that they did nothing for them. I'm not making that assertion. I'm just saying that the time of farmers being in charge of government, we've moved away from that. And the time of members of Congress being from farming families, we've moved away from that. And that shift in perspective corresponds somewhat with this rise of corporate agriculture and the erasure of farmers from public life.
So when you're talking about somebody having a viral moment and getting money, right? Like, let me throw money at you because you said the right things. So we've got a lot of these companies. There's four major meat processing companies that control 85 to 90% of your beef and pork, and right? So that it's no longer controlled by farmers. Here's the thing that is interesting to me and kind of confusing. I hear from farmers, we don't want government regulations, just stay off. Don't tell me what kind of milk I can sell. Don't tell me how to do this. Don't tell me what my inputs can be. Don't tell me how to farm. I know how to farm. That's a cow. I know how to milk it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yet then when you have what maybe started off as a farm and maybe contracts with family farmers becomes a big oligopoly or monopoly or however you want to call it, then farmers are like, wait a minute, like we can't actually make a living because there's this giant conglomerate of four companies controlling everything and making it impossible for me to even sell my meat.
Let me backfill before we get into this. In the United States, certain big players pretty much call the shots in key areas like seeds, chemicals, meat processing, and grain trade. Companies such as Bayer, Corteva Agriscience, Syngenta, Tyson Foods, JBS USA, Cargill, ADM, and Bunge have a strong grip on these markets, creating an oligopoly or monopoly of the farming industry. The presence of these big players in specific areas of the agricultural supply chain affects how the markets work, who gets to compete, and how money flows through the whole farming business.
Who's going to defend farmers big and small against multinational companies that are controlling our meat?
That's a great question. You know, my husband's family, longtime multi-generation farmers in Missouri, where they grew cotton, soybeans slowly over time. All of the family farms got bought up by large multinational corporations, and then they would get leased back to the family farmers who could kind of eke out a living, but it's not the same as owning your own land, as you well know. And we all know how valuable commercial farmland is. It's very valuable and it's very, very difficult to compete on price. It's really, really difficult for the average person to do that when you have somebody who has billions who can easily pay an extra $100K and that's no skin off their nose. So this is one of the perpetual challenges of living in the type of economic system that we have. Now, listen, there's no perfect economic system. Certainly communism didn't work, right? Like nobody's advocating for that. We know additionally that perfect capitalism, where the market literally controls everything, also does not work. And we know that it doesn't work because monopolies will develop. And that's the way it has always happened, is left unchecked, monopolies will develop, and those monopolies do not benefit consumers, and they do not benefit, in this case, family farmers. So this is the perpetual balance that is always trying to be struck with: how do we ensure people have the maximum amount of freedom to farm how they want? I don't need Uncle Sam telling me that I should plant this on April 11th. Like I got this. Right? I don't need your assistance. You don't know better than me. You did not grow up on this piece of land. Like, bye-bye. It's perfectly understandable why people resist having government tell them what to do. Perfectly understandable. But on the other hand, allowing a capitalist system that will speed towards monopoly also does not benefit them. Too much of one thing ultimately ends up being harmful. We can't have no regulations and then everybody drinks tainted milk, right? And gets sick and gets sick with like listeria and whatever. We can't have no regulations. Some farming regulations dramatically decreased child mortality from things like tainted milk. So we need some regulations to keep our food supply safe. but we don't need so many regulations that it prohibits people from doing their job. So it's about trying to find this balance between how do we keep people safe? How do we let people have the freedom to do their job? But then now you have to throw in this notion that how do we protect family farmers from massive multinational corporations? And in some cases, how do we protect family farmers from foreign countries that are buying up portions of our farmland because they can't grow alfalfa in Saudi Arabia, but they can grow it in Arizona with tremendous amounts of irrigation. And then they can use that alfalfa for the things that they want to use it for. So how do we protect family farmers from this situation? And the choices really do come down to let capitalism run unfettered and let the chips fall where they may, or government involvement. Those are often the two choices in this scenario. Either the government needs to ensure that there is more competition by minimizing monopolies and limiting the power of foreign countries like China, like Saudi Arabia, limiting their power to purchase farmland in the United States, and these giant multinational corporations limiting their ability to continue to consolidate power, because that is what happens left unchecked, right? This is unrelated to farming, but just earlier this week, JetBlue and Spirit Airlines wanted to merge. And a judge was like, no can do. That is going to make a bad situation for the consumer. Having two separate airlines is better than one. And I think you can make a similar argument when it comes to these giant multinational agricultural companies being able to acquire each other and continue to consolidate and build their power and squeeze out everybody else. So probably the answer is we need to do a better job enforcing our antitrust rules to prevent giant monopolies from being formed. And in terms of what other regulations we might need, those are the types of things that I think Congress truly needs to hear from farmers on, right? I used to live off the grid in northern Minnesota, 20 miles from the nearest paved road. And we had a lot of animals, but we were not farming for profit. We had horses, we had cows, we had chickens, pigs, sheep, geese, but we were using them for our own purposes, right? That's my experience with farming. And then, of course, my husband's family has been farming forever. I don't farm. Like, I grow flowers, okay? I grow flowers for fun. I'm like, oh, look at my irises. My petunias are doing great. It's been so warm and humid. They love it. Who am I to tell farmers what they need, right? I'm not the person that government should be listening to on this regard. Farmers are the people that government should be listening to in this regard. What is it that would be helpful to you? What is it that you need our assistance with? And also, what is it that you do not need our assistance with? I don't need you to tell me to plant this on April 11th. I sure do not. You know what I mean? But I alone cannot go up against these multinational corporations. That is where the power of the federal government has to be wielded, sure. Because individual farmers can't do it on their own. And that is one way that I think farmers need to have more of a voice in government. Just as all constituents who are being affected by legislation should have a say in what that legislation looks like, because they know what they need. And some dudes in a tie in a marble office, how would they know unless farmers tell them? So having a voice, I think, is an important component of making the system work better.
Yeah, I might argue that maybe from my four farmers podium that Congress needs to hear from you about it too, because do you want to go to your, let's call it your supermarket, to pick up some steak for dinner? And it says USA raised beef, product of the USA, right? So you're like, oh, ranchers here in Ohio, whatever, wherever they come from, this is meat from the US. It's actually not, more often than not. We're importing meat. We import a carcass. And if we process it here, meaning we cut it into a pretty little steak for you, we call it U.S. meat.
Just recently, the USDA fixed this labeling problem. The new product of the USA label requires that your beef is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed here in the United States. Ranchers and consumers are over the moon about this new regulation. But be warned here, this regulation does not go into effect until 2026. Until then, cattle raised in other countries with varying standards can import a carcass for processing in the U.S. and call it U.S. meat.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying, that Congress needs to hear from consumers as well, and that consumers should care about where their food comes from. I don't disagree with you. Where I think that farmers need to have a bigger voice is in helping regulatory agencies, like the Department of Agriculture, like the United States Congress, helping them understand exactly what the situation is so that they're not just, first of all, treating farmers like pawns, but also they're not writing legislation that actually harms instead of helps because they are not connected to farming, because they went to business school or they went to law school or they were raised rich and they have absolutely no connection to where their food comes from. Is it right that those are the people who decide for farmers exactly what should be happening or what kind of regulations are needed? So I really do think that it's important to have, you know, in politics, they use this word stakeholders. This word stakeholders is kind of like, I don't like it. But for lack of a better term, the stakeholders need to have a seat at the table, and too often they do not. Now, that's not to say that they should have the only seat and that consumers should just completely ignore the very real issues that farmers are facing. That's also not to say that Congress won't pay more attention. If more people bring attention to it, the better this will be. And that's one of the ways that I think your platform can assist consumers is in helping them understand what the issues actually are, because farmers have become so invisible and people are very removed from their food supplies. The average consumer has no idea. They have no idea what's going on. And so providing education to people, as you do, is tremendously important. And also, farmers need a seat at the regulatory table, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. The education of consumers to be like, okay, you're not farming anymore. It's okay. You can buy your groceries from a farmer or from a supermarket, but you should care about them. So don't leave it to somebody else, because ultimately it's your food, it's your health, it's your family traditions, it's your planet.
And it's your money when there are lots of government policies that impact the cost of food. Immigration policies impact the cost of food. As we know, there's a lot of immigrant labor involved in agriculture. So this is a much more multifaceted issue than just, you know, Bob in Iowa who has a dairy farm.
It's all incredibly complicated and interconnected. I do feel for farmers where they are like, well, they're not even voting on the farm bill, so they don't care.
I completely understand why they feel that way. They're not wrong to feel that way. They're not wrong, because if farmers were a priority, they would treat them as such. So they're not wrong to feel this way.
Yeah, the priority has shifted, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I do think, right, yes, it's farmers and it's us making sure that it becomes a priority again. It affects everything. If you spend a little time, and I spend way too much time looking through the farmer lens, you realize that it affects everything in your life, your personal health. And I know, you know, like healthcare is a big issue. People are paying huge health care bills.
Yes.
And that's really devastating. But let's make sure our food is less industrialized, or at least there are choices and a balance. I like to think about the opportunity for consumers and all of those really lovely people on social media to have an opportunity to participate in making a difference without having to stop their entire lives and do a dissertation on farming or government or, you know, so how do we know more than we knew yesterday? What's one fact we can pick up? And what's one activity that we can do to move the needle a little bit? And so I really try to focus on these small actions that can make a big difference. And I know you understand that. So thanking farmers right now, we're really trying to thank them across the country. And I really feel like it's a little action. It's not going to line their pockets. But I've heard from so many farmers, especially the small farmers who feel very marginalized, that it makes a huge difference.
My background is in teaching and not in farming. But I can tell you firsthand that teachers, also feel very, very unappreciated and politicized and marginalized in perhaps a similar way to farmers. And like, they're not given a seat at the table, that they're being used as political pawns, that nobody actually cares about the very important work that they're doing. And I hear from teachers all the time, in the same way that you probably hear from farmers, that somebody just saying, "Hey, I appreciate your work. Hey, thanks for showing up today. Hey, you know, my kid likes your class." That goes such a long way to keep people in the classroom. Just feeling slightly appreciated or respected in the community goes a long way to keeping them in the classroom and doing their important work. And listen, we all want to feel appreciated at work. We all want somebody to be like, "Hey, I see what you're doing. I appreciate your effort. Good job on that. We wouldn't be the same without you." Everyone wants to feel appreciated at work. But especially when we are talking about these professions like farming that are so integral to the backbone of society, that we would truly die, life or death situation without farmers, right? You can argue that there's perhaps no more important profession because of the life or death issue when it comes to obtaining food, that even just taking 5 minutes out of your day to educate yourself on something that is important to farmers, to contribute to a crowdfunding fundraiser that makes grants for farmers, like some of the things that you have been up to, by intentionally purchasing locally grown fruits and vegetables or food, even if you go to a farmer's market, saying to the person behind the stand, "Hey, I appreciate your work. Keep farming. Keep doing your important job." We don't actually have a full picture of exactly how important that appreciation is. There's a lot of stories throughout history where somebody has made a decision to do something terrible. Either they've made a decision to commit some kind of act of violence, or they're going to quit their important job, or they're going to harm themselves in some way. And what changed their mind was a kind word from a stranger. A single kind word from a stranger made them feel less alone, made them feel like what they do matters, that it almost felt like a sign from above that somebody cares about you.
When we acknowledge that farmers are central to our lives, our food, our health, our environment, and our land ownership and stewardship, our communities, our policies, and our economy, we will see that farmers need a stronger voice in our government. They should not be political pawns. And we may all benefit from reinserting farmer wisdom into what's going on with our food, our land, and the interests of agribusiness and multinationals. Sharon McMahon understands the trajectory of history and government and how it's not including farmers as it once was. The small farmers are being left out of the story, and it's up to them and to consumers like you to step up and make sure they remain viable. Your life depends on it. Sharon's upcoming book, The Small and the Mighty, includes stories about everyday Americans who changed the course of history. We know farmers who are a part of that story, that history, even modern-day farmers who we see at the farmers market. Let's not forget them. Let's not take them for granted. Let's celebrate them. Let's support them by shopping with them. You can find other ways to support them, easy ways, through the For Farmers movement. You will find a link in the show notes to that, as well as some links on where you can find Sharon. If you are not already a fan or a follower, a book club member, I'm sure you will be now. Thank you, Sharon, for showing up for farmers today and for sharing your insights on the intersection of government and farmers today and in our history. Thanks for being here for another episode of Talk Farm to Me. It was fun to step off of the farm today and talk farm in a new way. More of this is coming to you soon. But also, more farmers, hardworking people from whom we can all learn a lot about our land, our food, our options for better health, cleaner environment, and more vibrant communities. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and I will see you soon. Maybe at a farm near you.
people today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.